Let me start by saying it's a huge honor and privilege to be able to speak at Usenix Security. When I was a grad student, my advisor told me, it's like, look, you get to graduate if you get a paper into CCS, S&P, or Usenix. And I got a paper into CCS. So, but to me, to be able to do an invited talk at Usenix Security is like, I called my parents. You know, I was like, Mom, Dad, get this! And they're like, I don't know what you're talking about. And I was like, that's okay, it's good. All right, so I was asked to talk a little bit about some of the work I've been doing over the past few years. As you see, my name is Adam O'Donnell. I was the director of cloud engineering at a company called Immunet, director and co-founder. And as of announced to the street January 5th of this year, we were acquired by a company called Sourcefire. For those of you who here has used Snort or Clam AV. All right, so most of the room. So Sourcefire is the corporate parent of Snort and Clam AV. And we were acquired back in January, and now my team is responsible for Clam as well as the Sourcefire endpoint product. So that's where that technology is now. About Immunet, so we founded the company in mid-2008 with the goal of building next-generation antivirus. Anyone here work for an antivirus company? I see any hands? Awesome. Good. Because I'm going to talk about some things that we're working on and what we have in our next product, and we can make fun of some different AV companies and call shenanigans. Our funding was through Altos Ventures and Tech Operators, two VCs. Tech Operators is based out of Atlanta. Altos Ventures is on Sand Hill Road. For those of you who are in the Bay Area tech scene, or those of you not in the Bay Area tech scene, Sand Hill Road is the place where dreams are made. It's a strip off of 280, which is just venture capitalist by venture capitalist by venture capitalist. And it was very exciting going down there on a regular basis and being told that your ideas are terrible. But, you know, eventually one picks up on it, thinks you have a good idea, they invest, they make a bunch of money, you make some money, everyone's happy. So we were acquired by Sourcefire December 2010 and announced to the street January 2011. About me, I was founded in late 78 to build the next generation of my family line. I was funded through Guardant, which was the first managed security services company. Did a bunch of consulting work, and I went to Drexel University on NSF GRFP, which is a great program, and not like anyone out here doesn't know what that is, but you know, it was useful. After grad school, I went out to industry in 2005 for a company called CloudMark, which is an anti-spam firm based out here in San Francisco. And I left there once we got Immunet funded in 2009 and went did that full time. So I'm going to talk a little bit about antivirus. And so when I say antivirus, I'm referring to, by the way, this is completely true. No, so when I talk about antivirus, I'm talking about any software that sits resident on the endpoint and flags stuff as being bad. I'm not super pedantic about what is the difference between malware or virus. Let's just say it's bad crap on the endpoint. So I'm going to use these terms interchangeably. Don't get upset. All right, let's talk a little bit about the ancient history of antivirus. So 1980s style, we had maybe 100-odd viruses on a regular basis that would be in real propagation. They were pretty low mutation rate, even though there's proof of concept technologies such as the mutation engine or the polymorphic engine, I think it was called. But these things propagated rather slow, mostly via sneaker net, right? You had your system disk in drive A, you had another system disk in drive B, or your data disk in drive B, you turned on your machine, and you know, lo and behold, something copied from the one sector to the other, and your computer was then stoned. Does anyone remember this virus? This a long time ago. Okay, a couple people. The rate of propagation was very low. The rate of new virus generation was very low. And mostly it was proof of concept type technologies. On the antivirus side, the low number of viruses meant there was a low definition count. These things were not very frequently updated. You would have analysts would come up with some new rule to catch some new virus. They would put it on a floppy disk. They would mail it out to you via U.S. Postal Service, or you'd go to the store and buy some update disk and update your AV system. This is in the 80s. How many people remember these things? When they first came out, the USRs, these things were, what, $300 a piece? It was awesome. I remember getting my first 14.4, and I was like, oh, I don't have to save as much time in the time bank to download files with this board. So back in the 90s, you know, you had on the order of, you know, a couple thousand, tens of thousands of unique virus samples. Again, the mutation rate was fairly low, but the propagation methods still via SneakerNet, BBSs, and the internet. But these things were still relatively not a headache for the AV companies to deal with. Definitions started to be updated daily to weekly. You would be able to pull them off of a BBS. You would call up some 800 number, download a new def file. People used to push FPROT updates over FidoNet, for example. These are very ancient means of updating AV software, but you may recall them. And you're able to have business hour response teams, people who would be able to collect the malware, they write their definitions, they didn't have to go and do follow-the-sun type operations, because by the end of the day, you know, even if you came up with some new rule at 3 o'clock in the morning, a thing actually wasn't going to hit your end user for another week or 2 weeks. It wasn't that big of a deal. Okay, so what's it look like today? I didn't know what to make the internet look like today. So I was going to pick a dropped iPhone or something like that. I don't know, but I think figured can and twine. The number of viruses, I'm going to use the term as it's supposed to be used, is actually exponentially increasing by identification of unique SHAs or unique cryptographic signatures. Again, I use that term as it's supposed to be used. In 2003, or 2000, we had about 50,000. 2003, we had 100,000. 2008, you know, a million. Today, we're looking at 10 million. I've heard some estimates about maybe 100 million by the end of the year, depending upon how big of a sensor network you actually have. The average lifetime in field of a piece of malware is 2 to 3 days. So, and why I say is it not resident on the person's machine that was infected, as in a source of infection. So someone goes and puts something up on a website and it's being held there. These things will mutate so quickly that within 2 to 3 days, you're not going to find anyone being infected by a single shot, by that shot anymore. So this is just, I want you to understand what the mutation rate is that you look at for in the virus world. Antivirus definitions end up being pushed down up to every 5 minutes from a day. You have follow the sun response teams. So when you talk about Symantec outsourcing or McAfee outsourcing a large number of jobs to India, they're not doing it because they want to ship jobs to India. They're doing it because when the North American team goes asleep, the European team wakes up. And then when the European team wakes up, or the other way around. But the idea is that everyone's got teams that are on 8-hour offsets, that as one team goes to bed, the next one gets up and continues writing rules. And then they just push them out 24 hours a day, 7 days a week. So rather than being on a daily basis for these things, they're shoving these things down every 5 minutes, and they're pushing down the updates on internet only at this point. To give you an idea of the scale of the updates, I believe Symantec spends around $30 million a year on Akamai bills just for Norton antivirus updates. So real money. This is expensive to actually do this. Okay, so how do AV firms know what viruses exist? Many of you work in academia. How do you get your virus samples? You beg, you borrow, you try to grab them from somewhere. The way that most antivirus samples are actually handed around is basically via a good old boy network. All the AV firms know each other. Everyone's kind of job hop between them. They form what are called sample sharing alliances. And these sample sharing alliances are basically, I'll call up, I don't know, some AV firm, Rising or something like that, someone in some other country, and say, hey, I have samples on a daily basis. I'll drop to you as long as you drop samples to me. And I say, sure, fine. And everyone does this. I mean, you'll have if you were to draw out a graph, you see a connected graph of about 50 nodes, everyone swapping samples back and forth. You are able to trade samples if you have samples to trade. Around 50% of a vendor's convictions or in-field detections will come just off of what they traded with someone else. I'll give you an idea. So half of everything your AV engine is able to detect is only because that they traded a sample with someone else. these networks. Okay, so back in the 80s, they had these informal sample sharing alliances. In the 90s, they had these informal sample sharing alliances. In 2000, they had these informal sample. And you get to kind of get the idea. This is the way that AV firms collect their intelligence onto what is actually going on out in the field. I would like to notice that this is a log scale. It's kind of, if it's linear in the log scale, it's not a good thing. So we actually have two combined problems. The number of viruses is going up through the roof. So there's the actual swapping of samples to pass around information becomes pretty much useless because you're never going to be able to cover enough samples. And you also are never going to be able to fully get your analyst team to get through everything on a daily basis. You're just completely overwhelmed. And the other problem is intelligence. We don't know what we don't know in some ways, in that we don't know what content is out there, who is seeing what content, what his lifetime is, when things are actually infecting end users versus just being hosted on some website, what things are collected via honeypots, what are actually the real problems that your end users face. As a result, if you look at current efficacy of AV products, if you turn off updates, you have about and you left yourself on generic detections and machine learning stuff, you have about 40% efficacy after 2 weeks. Virus Total claims 99% efficacy, but on real malware, you're talking about 80% in the general case. To say that AV in its current form is an effective mechanism for keeping you clean is pretty much a falsehood. But at the same time, everyone's like, oh, well, AV is terrible, you should throw it away. Well, do you know what's worse than AV? Not having it. Okay, so now I've painted this whole doom and gloom picture, but you know, let's talk about what cloud can do for you. So I said that was gonna be a little bit about cloud security, and so what is the cloud? I like Amazon's definition. The cloud is a term used to describe the internet. This actually is Amazon's cloud music player, FAQ. Okay, so the cloud is basically, it's a client server, all right? You have a thin client on one end, a thick server on the other end. And so all your data is held on the server side, all your computation is done on the server side, and your actual end presentation is all done on the client side. You guys are familiar with this model from, you know, Usenix crowd. You probably all have PDP-11s in your basement. I don't know. But this is nothing really new. And really, I think the driving factor is the ratio of bandwidth available to CPU available. Now we got a crap load more bandwidth, and a relative amount of CPU is dropping. As a result, there's a push to push things back over to the server side. When you didn't have this, when it was all pure on a PC side, you had your pure, you know, heavy client, everything on the desktop side. It's because the bandwidth we had was a telephone wire. It wasn't much to actually do anything interesting. The other big thing about cloud is that it's a issue of business models, where business models are built around pricing as a function of usage. Amazon, you can buy a server by the hour. It's a dime an hour, I think. At initial pricing, it goes up to $6 an hour for the big end machines. Before this, there was no real way of ever saying, I would like to buy an hour of server time. Actually, in modern technology terms, you know, years ago, yes, of course, you know, back in my day, but this is why cloud's gotten so much attention. People say, oh, it's just a marketing term. It's like, in some ways, yes, but the reason why it's gotten so much popularity is that someone like me and a couple of his friends can go to a bar and say, let's start a company, go write the code, go start up, spin up an Amazon server, and then the first month's bill is $20. And then we could run like that for 6 months or 14 months and then go raise capital and actually have a proven product versus having to have the capex of building out an entire server infrastructure and hiring a guy that comes in and maintains the boxes when they blow up. Okay, so what does cloud antivirus look like? Conventional, This is a computer. So conventional antivirus, basically someone goes and downloads a file, they open it up, the antivirus product goes and intercepts all the kernel calls, it goes and redirects it to a database on local resident of the system, which has a set of hashes. These hashes go and take a look to say, is it good or bad? If it thinks it looks like something you've already scanned in your system, it may do nothing with it. If it passes a first set of hashes, it sends it down to Heuristic Engine or a couple other systems. Long story short, just talks local to the system. So what's the cloud? So what we do is we go and replace that with the internet. And you may say to yourself that this is radically slower. You would be surprised. I'm getting to why. I want to emphasize this is actually what we have built and another company, Panda, is actually built. So this technology is actually working in the field, currently being used. On our side, we have about, we're tracking 30 million binaries actively. Those are clean and larger volume malicious content. We handle, probably about 10,000 queries a second, maybe about 20,000 queries a second across 10 to 20 servers. 24 hours a day, 7 days a week. And our users don't differentiate between, and our users actually find our product to be much faster than conventional antivirus products. Okay. So when a file gets opened up, it computes a set of crypto hashes off the file, a set of fuzzy hashes, a set of machine learning vectors, and then it goes and sends those up to the back end. And back end looks up in its cache, and then says, okay, this is good, this is bad, and tells the end user. End user caches that information for when he goes and opens up the same file again, but it's just like a conventional AV product. All the decision-making process is on the other end of the internet. Architecture. It's a multi-tier data storage model. You have a cache, you have a database, you have flat files. This is how you build these things. I'll get into a little bit more about why you had to go with why a structure like this, but this is not atypical for any kind of database or any kind of transaction lookup system. Okay, so why is this even possible? So if you look at the number of viruses, yeah, it's skyrocketing, but the number of actual unique system binaries on an individual machine hasn't been doing that. And when you go and you do a full scan in your machine, you take every single file, you load up this entire database into memory, and maybe like a gig in size, and you blow out your L1, L2, L3 cache on your CPU, and your system slows to a crawl. But globally, people have a lot of the same files. Everyone has a copy of ServiceHost.exe. Everyone has a copy of all the standard Windows DLLs. And so your cache locality is actually very, very, very high on a global scale as compared to a local scale. So if you would initially say, oh, well, you know, I have all the costs of doing the lookup locally plus the internet time, that's not quite true. You have the cost of doing the cache lookup that maybe 1 out of 10,000 or 1 out of 20,000 other people did, and you get your response almost immediately for that file. So it's radically faster if you consider it from a global context. The bandwidth for round-trip lookups is dramatically lower than for shipping virus updates. The reason why is you have so many fewer unique files on your desktop. When you go and you ship a virus update for an AV product, you have to ship a full set of every virus ever seen. There are some of these AV companies that are still shipping down virus updates for products for that will affect Windows 3.1. And it's because they have certain service contracts that require it. You don't have to do that with Cloud AV. You only have to go and ship down the updates or the definitions for the files that are actually on the person's system. Let's be honest, low latency bandwidth is practically ubiquitous for the customers that you actually care about. It is. If someone's a 56K modem, they're not going to be paying for software anyway. No, I mean, not to be flippant about it, but they're not paying for bandwidth, they're not going to be paying for an AV product. So what does this give you? So you get intelligence because of all the queries that are coming up. You're able to get improved accuracy, and you're able to get data to foreign and apply novel analysis techniques. I'm going to get into that in a bit. Intelligence. You get continuous collection of who saw what, where, and in what context. just by the query log. Now, that may sound concerning from a document standpoint, but from the standpoint of the kinds of things I'm concerned about, such as anyone who runs IE6 sees a single file downloaded over and over again with different hashes, but the same file name. Continuously, but the same fuzzy hash. If I didn't have this global awareness, I wouldn't be able to flag that. But with global awareness, I say, okay, this guy over here has this file being downloaded with the same fuzzy hash, this one the same fuzzy hash, this one for the same fuzzy hash, all coming down from Internet Explorer, all being seen on execute, meaning the person goes to some web page, the thing executes automatically, and the SHA keeps on changing. That sounds like a rotating packed binary. You'd be astounded at how many of these things get missed by a standard antivirus. But this is what you get when you have a global view. Any file that is further suspicious, that's suspicious, requires further analysis here, we'll get further metadata on. So, for example, if the thing really looks like a virus, you can say, okay, I'm going to track it for this user. As this person goes on in his day, you may put that piece of software in a quarantine sandbox or something like that. But as the sample comes in, either from him, if they approve it to be uploaded, or from a third-party vendor, you're able to hand-analyze it or do some additional testing on it, and then go back to the end user and then give him further information. I'll get into that in a few minutes as well. More importantly, as I mentioned before, you don't know what malware is on your end user's machines or your end user being affected by if you don't get heavy amounts of analytics back. If you're running conventional antivirus, they take every virus definition shipped down, even for viruses that are only seen in China, only for viruses only seen in Finland, which is actually very, very commonplace. But in this situation, you're able to know exactly what your end users are being affected by and focus on that content and then fix it from that priority order. While some people think this is like really concerning from a privacy standpoint, at the same time, I look at it as, from an engineering standpoint, taking data. Okay, why does this affect accuracy? As I mentioned before, you have a window of maybe a day to 5 minutes between when a conventional AV product will go and download updates to the person's desktop of new malware. Here, if something gets flagged as being bad, instantly, from that moment onward, that user is covered by it. They don't have to wait until that next update. So there's an update gap between when you publish a rule and when they get that accounts for a huge amount of malware infections. Being able to close that gap is one of the huge in this kind of technology. You're able to optimize around real metrics about unfailed efficacy. You can actually say, oh, well, I think that my efficacy of this product is 97% because I have a bunch of malware, I'm going to run through it and see what it catches and doesn't. No, in this case, you're able to say, okay, well, he looked up at this time, we have the hash, we know he said it was unknown at this time, we looked up at this time, same file, we know it's malicious at this time, we missed it there, therefore our efficacy is this. And you could be very honest with yourself and actually have real optimization goals. You could also do crowdsourced whitelisting and blacklisting, which I'm going to get to in a minute. But it also opens up all these areas for novel techniques, such as global prevalence tracking, knowing how often a file is seen out in the field, actually having real data for data mining, retrospective conviction and APT hunting. I'll get into these things. And you're going to see a bunch of pictures at this point because I don't want my competitors like looking exactly at, you know, my list of bullet points and passing around my deck. So there's an antivirus firm, I'm not going to name names, that a couple years ago had a vendor, or one of their customers, is getting smoked by a piece of malware. He's getting hammered by this thing. So he calls up his AV supplier and says, hey, look, we need some kind of rule to defend against this. We're getting trashed by it. So they had the analyst team write up the rule, and the guy kept on calling, and they push it through and skip QA. And part of the QA process is called falsing. Every AV firm does this. Falsing is basically saying test it against all clean files, make sure it doesn't smoke clean files. The file actually went and smoked servicetoast.exe, which is the daemon which takes DLLs on Windows and actually runs services out of them. So it trashed Windows machines. hundreds of thousands of Windows systems. And if you guys all cite the THERACT 25 as being an instance where, you know, you make a bug and people get killed, this shut down several hospitals and kids missed their freaking chemo because they couldn't actually get the dosing machines up and running because of this FP. This is severe, severe issues. Let's say you actually had global awareness of what is being flagged at any one time. You push down some rule and you see a single SHA-256 being flagged on tens of thousands of computers all at the same time. Modern malware does not have the same SHA-256 continuously. You don't see a single binary out on more than 1 or 2% of your machines if it's a piece of bad code. You don't. And so immediately you would know that this is a false positive, and you could take immediate action and fix it. This is something you can't do with conventional antivirus because on the local system, all you know is you smoked one file. But if you know on a global scale, you say, oh my God, I am going and trashing half my customers' computers. And you can take immediate action. That's really powerful and that's really important. This is what it looked like, by the way. It's not good. Okay, machine learning. How many people have backgrounds in machine learning here? Okay. What happens when you train on two samples, or a corpus A of that you're like compare to corpus B, right? And you don't have relative weightings. You get crap, okay? So you go and you say, okay, I have a bunch of malware in one bucket, I have a bunch of cleanware in one bucket. And if you don't know the relative weight at which the malware and the cleanware is seen, it makes it very, very, very hard to actually build good machine learning models. You see a couple AV firms spent years talking about how they're doing machine learning. In reality, most of these efforts are flops. And because they would have a couple Windows boxes that they extracted files from that would be our cleanware, and a bunch of files that they crawled and that's our cleanware, they have a bunch of malware samples. But they didn't know at which rate the malware samples are actually being seen in the field. So they actually couldn't sit down and say, hey, this file was being seen far more often than this file. Therefore, this should be more heavily weighted in my tree than this. But if you're collecting all this data, you can actually do direct data mining, machine learning training from your log files themselves and do continuous machine learning, updated on a continuous basis to give you very, very accurate models of what's clean and what's dirty in field. That's super powerful from a detection standpoint. Retrospective. So let's say you, this is what Google Image Search gave me for retrospective. I don't know. I don't listen to Suzanne Vega. Someone looks up a file on their machine on Tuesday. You allow the thing to be run into a quarantine folder or something along those lines, but it looks suspicious. On Thursday, you realize it's actually bad. You can go back to a specific user and tell them that this was a bad file and we made a mistake. This is very, very hard to do from a conventional AV standpoint because you don't know what that user's seen. You're going to be able to say, okay, well, here's all the updated files. If you've seen any of these things in my list, then that's good. But in this case, you actually go and do deep examination for a single user and say, this is what we missed. We're going to go back and fix it for you. AV doesn't do that right now. Well, everyone except for one product doesn't do that right now. Partially because people don't want to admit that detection can actually fail. We recognize that detection has limits, and therefore we're also going to fix things after the fact. Who here knows what an APT is, or have heard the marketing term? Show of hands. Okay, APT, Advanced Persistent Threat. It's something you see a lot in marketing literature now in the security space. It's another word for hacker. Basically, an APT is a piece of software written by a human being that has one goal only, which is infiltrate your network. And they will do anything they can to get in there. They will combine human intelligence by going and calling up the company, doing a bunch of social engineering, send out an email with the thing attached in the hopes that one of the employees will go and double-click on it, install it, and propagate inside the network. These things are custom-written pieces of code. You don't see them anywhere else. They look like it's a toolkit, you know, from something else, but it's generally pretty unique. Stuxnet, for those of you who know what it is, was what you would call an APT. These things are generally If it's an American company that's getting them, generally you would say it's a country of 1 billion people in East Asia that's actually writing them. But these aren't pieces of malware like you would think of a virus, like you would get in some collection source. They are custom pieces of code designed to compromise your system. How do you defend against something like this? Remember, the way most AV authors work is they have their own testing environment. They write a virus and they run it against every AV product until they see something that gets passed and they send it to you. So the defense component is completely shot. But again, if you have a running forensics log of what the person's been looking up, you can go back and say, okay, we've realized that this thing's an APT. We can actually tell you all the systems it's touched, what it's done since it's touched them, what additional software it's downloaded, and actually trace the file history of that drop. That is very powerful, and that's the way defense is going to be done. Because in a situation where these things are being QA'd against antivirus, what do you expect to do? They test it to make sure it won't get caught before they send it to you. So by definition, you're not going to be able to block it. Okay. I told you I was going to give you a little bit of an idea how to build something like this. But I'm not going to tell you all the nitty-gritty details, but I'll tell you how you shouldn't, you know, the things you should do so you don't get yourself blown up. Algorithm design. I know I'm talking to a bunch of academics. That's why I'm making this joke. Anything that is a polynomial time algorithm cannot work in a cloud environment. All right. Anything where n is a function of your number of users, your number of rules, anything that may grow as a system steadily gets older is not going to fly. Because what ends up happening is that users will queue up and they'll kind of get slow and they'll try to reload or refire off things again, and then everyone else backs up and you kind of have a little bit of a little bit of a meltdown. But in general, what is a good algorithm? Anything to O of one. Everyone who builds these things uses hash tables extensively. They use technologies like memcache. Very, very popular when constructing these things. If you're going to be doing anything that's a polynomial time algorithm, it should be a constant of the function of the file underneath, and that should even be a constant, like features of the PE header, for example. That way you actually can put real time bounds on a query on your back end. Anything that involves long-running simulation of a process or some kind of static analysis where you could have multiple loops in the code, fine. If you want to do something like that, do it at a way out of band process, but nothing that's in loop for the user query. And it's like, yeah, but you know, we could get done another 50 milliseconds for 90% of the cases. Yeah, but the problem is that the other 10% of the cases will cause everyone else to back up and it doesn't work anymore. Everything in your system's a queue. Everything. And there's bad queues and there's good queues. This is a bad queue. This is a good queue. So you want to shoot for something that's a deterministic service rate that you could have any arbitrary numbers of servers for them. Again, deterministic, it's an O of one algorithm actually servicing the thing. Anything, if you're doing MM1 modeling, again, you can't, it does not work in a cloud context because trying to be able to predict. Yeah. Yes, you could do a huge amounts of system engineering to say, oh, well, you know, under these cases, I'll fire up new servers. On the course of a normal day, you'll be running around your office with your hair on fire because half your users can't connect. You need to have very, very, very predictable queue behaviors. You need to have very predictable algorithm behaviors because so many parts of the system which are unpredictable that without these things, you're not going to be able to you're not going to be able to serve your users in a reliable context. Take only what you need. There's a tendency for people to want to accumulate as much data as possible and keep it in an online fashion because at some point in the future, you may be able to come up with some brand new algorithm which can go and flag new malware. But the problem is there's no technology really that allows you to do this at this point. If you guys are into databases, and you want a good project for one of your students, build a high quality key value data store that auto shards and is provably stable and has very, very few bugs. The current state of the art for the stack technology that everyone uses is kind of like a, it's like writing a CPU, right? You have a multi-threaded server. And yes, I said writing a CPU. I used to, you know, I speak VHDL. You have a multi-thread server that talks to Memcache, that talks to MySQL, and that talks to log files. The idea being, you know, as queries come in, all your queries are served in O one time in a very very fast state. If anything is a cache miss, you go into MySQL. Everything else, you skip. You depend upon log files for your long-term analytics. You don't save anything other than what you need to answer immediate queries. The cutting edge is asynchronous server technology, Memcache layer, and then some of the what are called NoSQL technologies, which are basically key-value data stores. Redis, MongoDB, React, Cassandra, Bigtable. I'm missing 30 of them. Everyone wants this. No one has it. No one has it in a way that works. Everyone who goes and rolls these things out has them blow up in their face. They scream and complain about them. The people who have been able to be really successful with them, you're talking about Google, Foursquare with Mongo, a couple other companies with a couple other technologies. I think Zynga is really big on Membase. But the stability across the board's not there, and the experience is not there, and none of these things are fire and forget. So if you actually, as another statement, if you want to VC-back a company, find someone who's actually building a key-value data store. It's really, really high quality and, like, at the level of, like, Oracle quality, and that will go and pop on market for, you know, nine figures. But if you try to store everything continuously in your system, you're going to spend a fortune of hardware. You're going to go nowhere fast. So, again, follow the CPU analogy. Be really, really choosy about your data. Anything that's that is a straight file query, like I'm scanning this file, you want it to come out of cache. You can't go back to database or anything else like that. And you can't actually do any real-time computation. It has to be something you've computed offline in a separate process and backfilled at a later time. Online computation for this stuff does not work. So in conclusion, a lot of people complain about antivirus, but it doesn't have to be terrible. Antivirus is basically a technology that stops bad stuff from running on people's machines. There's a lot of different ways of stopping bad stuff from running on people's machines. You can use all the conventional techniques you want, and then on top of that, you can build into forensic systems. You could do something innovative. There's a lot of people in the security industry who will go and throw their hands up and say that, you know, the problem's intractable and therefore we shouldn't even bother. But, you know, just because there's not a cure for every single human disease doesn't mean we shouldn't be giving measles vaccines. And it doesn't mean we shouldn't be analyzing, you know, people who pick up something new and try and figure out what we could do about it. Also, Cloud AV isn't just antivirus. It's, if you think about it, it's traditional catch and block antivirus. It's this idea of real-time analytics, the idea of real-time repair based upon long-term data analytics, and also deep forensics and the kind of stuff you need to actually solve the APT problem. But we don't have to limit ourselves to just reinventing antivirus. We can reinvent a whole host of different acronyms in the security space. HIPS and HIDs definitely would be something that's worth looking at. HIPS and HIDs is basically watching the call graphs of applications and then saying, okay, well, this application isn't allowed to run because it's taking these following system calls, or it's branched along this path. Let's say you were to collect a call graph of every single application as it ran out there and build some database and say, okay, we know that all these calls over here are anomalous in IE6. And we're going to issue a new rule for IE6 that says any calls that go down this path, we know it's a piece of malware. That would be a powerful technology. That's something that's interesting to do. Data leakage protection. This is an obvious one. Two-factor authentication. Anyone know Doug Song? Yeah. Okay. So this is Doug's new company. It's a company called Duo Security. And they're doing two-factor authentication in the cloud. So that way, let's say, for example, someone stole your seeds and you had to throw away all your crypto tokens. Well, rather than doing that, you actually go and if you're hosting all your technology in the back end, yes, it's a higher threat risk. But at the other end of it, you can segment it off and have different seed keys for each of these things. So if one sector of your customer base got popped, it'd be easier just to revoke all his keys and issue new ones for that one user base and avoid the RSA problem. You guys know about that, right? Okay. Yeah, it was bad. Okay, so any questions? Please, line up with the microphone.
How about privacy? You're seeing everybody's files. If you can go against an Oracle.
We're going actually only after executables for that reason. Getting to see all the documents, I think, is a little bit more sketchy. Seeing the rate at which people will execute Internet Explorer, I think, is a little bit less. Yes, there are privacy implications. We disclose that in the EULA. What's a good way of solving it? I don't know. But I cannot actually for the life of me think a different way of solving an endpoint security problem in the future other than whitelisting. And which people get upset about saying that I don't have the freedom to run anything I want on my computer. I don't know of another way of protecting end users.
You just mentioned we could use machine learning to achieve cloud computing security. In my understanding, usually people use machine learning to detect anomaly events. If you give me high-dimensional complex data, we can use machine learning to find out the patterns. So we compare the patterns to some normal or abnormal ones, so we know it's anything's wrong there.
Yeah.
So could you give more examples about how we could use advanced machine learning techniques to achieve cloud computing security?
So in this particular case, what we do is actually pair up a SHA, and we'll pair up a machine learning fingerprint. And we do that in our queries. And using that, we're able to actually do straight up machine learning as if the files were on our system. Because we're able to say, okay, we know all these things are good, we know all these things are bad. And it's just that massive amount of data collection makes the models so much more accurate. And also having a relative rate at which things come in makes them more accurate. If you know one feature is overrepresented and it's associated with clean files, or if, for example, if a feature is only seen in one clean file, but that one clean file is on every single person's machine, then your trees become far less false positive prone.
How do you deal with the internet being down?
If the internet's down, then you don't generally get viruses right now.
That's sadly not true.
There is also via USB. Via USB keys, there's a bunch of ways of handling that.
For cloud, verification, is there a local cache of stuff?
Yes. Okay. Absolutely. There's a local cache.
I work for a tiny little, multinational bank, and we worry about these sorts of things.
No, I understand. So there's a local cache, and there's also other techniques such as saying what we call port control. So you get to actually say port control goes up or new files cannot be installed while the machine is offline from the internet. But there's a collection of techniques you're able to say things are more tightly locked down. But the vast majority of malware is installed over the internet.
I'm not saying it's not installed over the internet. I'm saying that it may have been
My internet or your internet?
It may have been acquired with my internet, but didn't hit the machine that is going to need to look at it until after the internet went down. There's a time delay that frequently does happen, especially with horrid email things and stuff that...
So like an email hits your mail server and a guy's able to pull it down, but there's no route to the internet for him to look it up. Yeah, that's a good point. And actually, the way we handle that is we do have an offline engine as well. It's just not our primary source of efficacy. We also have offline cache, all these techniques. I'm not saying we should throw out the entire baby with the bathwater with the conventional stuff. And we have all those things. I just feel that piece of technology is starting to reach its limits of what you're able to do.
Yeah, and it's a different use case from, home users.
Right. Well, and actually, so even on our enterprise side, they are... pretty much, it's the assumption of the team is that there is going to be
more
internet access.
Not that the internet is broken today, but that we're being denial of service.
Right. Understood. No, actually, we do account for that, and it's again for those reasons.